Welcome back. You're listening to Rogues and Vagabonds, the Watermen of the River Thames. I'm Jean Di Marino. We've heard the watermen reminiscing. They worked hard and they played hard. But these days, their stairs and causeways and the old entrances to the docks lie unnoticed and unused. After hundreds of years, their way of life is passing into history. Coming up, we discover why.
It was a community, and they destroyed a community. That's what they done.
But first, how did they earn the label Rogues and Vagabonds? The work of driving a barge encouraged a rare independence in its watermen. For hours, they were solely responsible for handling their craft. Using the tide to get about, steering under bridges, reacting to what the weather had in store, they had to be able to think for themselves. Eddie Chamberlain says they developed a character that made the best out of tough situations.
You very rarely found an unemployed waterman or lighterman, because the way we'd been brought up with the river and how you learnt to, we used to call it duck and dive, you was wily and you found yourself another job.
But sometimes making the best of things meant turning circumstances to your own advantage. Terry Carver.
We was all accountants, weren't we?
Yes. Yes.
We had to work our own wage bills out, and we could always make two become six.
And more. It seems that many of the practices of the early watermen hadn't changed. A survey carried out in the 1800s showed one-third of Thames workers were involved in illegal activity. And centuries later, pilfering still went on. Alan Jennings.
It was a way of life, I must admit. We shouldn't say it, but we did help ourselves to one or two bits and pieces.
Yeah, but it was ours, though, Al, wasn't
but,
it?
Well, yeah.
Samuel Johnson, wasn't he? He wrote somewhere.
Vagabonds. Yes,
they're all known thieves, rogues and vagabonds, he wrote about us people.
Eddie Chamberlain.
That's what he thought. It's a waterman, he wrote, because the watermen were the original ones that rowed people across the river because there was no bridges. It was like a taxi service for the rich. But he said they're all known thieves and vagabonds. And that's what we came from. But it wasn't true.
Fire, fire, fire down below. It's fetch a bucket of water, girls, it's fire down below.
Still, the time spent living on their wits stood the watermen in good stead for what was to come. When the end came, it arrived suddenly. Between 1960 and 70, containerisation, the practice of shipping goods in standardised steel boxes, changed the watermen's way of life forever. Kevin Brown saw it happen on the ground. Well, from high above the ground, actually.
I was a docker, and I see the change from general cargo through containerisation. Now, when I first went in, we used to do general cargo. But they used to deliver the barges to the wharves, and we discharged them. General light cargo was all done by hand and loose. It was taken out of the ship, put in a barge, taken out of the barge, put in a warehouse, taken from the warehouse onto a lorry. So it was handling all the time, so four times you've handled it. Whereas with a container, one lift onto a lorry, gone.
Containerisation was good for the merchants. It reduced the time it took to unload goods and cost less.
Now, in the old days, they'll tell you, we used to have five hatches in a ship with 13 men per hatch. That's 65 men without the shore gang. Now, I was a crane driver which discharged the containers. I could discharge a ship with the same amount of men, 13 men, it could be discharged and loaded on two tides. That's the difference. I didn't need a top man for a start. A man who directs you down, I could look over the crane, I could travel out, look over, go onto the ship, lift the container up and go away.
But the barges driven by the lightermen just couldn't take the load. The containers called for special ships with large holds.
These were massive, great vessels, as you know, everybody knows, but it presented huge problems for the Port of London because these enormous vessels just couldn't get down the Thames.
Fiona Rule is the author of a book called London's Docklands, A History of the Lost Quarter. She explains that London's port went into decline, in some cases losing millions of pounds a year. One by one, the ancient docks and wharves lining the Thames closed. The Port of London Authority developed one site, Tilbury in Essex, that was closer to the sea.
I went to a wharf in 1964. Brand new, spanking new wharf. Was out of date the day they opened the door because they couldn't handle the next generation of containers.
The change was frighteningly sudden. When you imagine that in the 1950s, the docks were absolutely at their peak. They were handling more cargo than they ever had in their entire existence. And then by 1980, every single one of those docks, with the exception of Tilbury, had closed.
Fiona Rule says the decline was hastened by the workers' militancy.
The port workers realised exactly what was going to happen and it would result in the destruction of their communities. And so they fought tooth and nail to try and keep the docks open for as long as they possibly could.
Docker Kevin Brown.
We wanted the employers to levy containerisation, put a levy on, say, nominal fee, £1, wouldn't have made no difference to them, £1, but it would have taught people to do different trades, to become different in the industry, but wider.
It was to no avail.
Inevitably, they couldn't stem the tide. You can't stop progress. Container ships were happening. They were incredibly more economical than using traditional ships. And so the docks were just forced to close despite the best efforts of a lot of people to keep them open.
But the watermen believed the Port of London Authority was motivated more by the docks' real estate potential. John Elliston was a shop steward at the time.
We had a committee called TOW, T-O-W. We was pressing and telling the government, the officials, why? Why not use this River Thames? We've got licences from Teddington to the north, 70 miles of the main artery going through London, which was the River Thames. Germany are using their rivers, Amsterdam, everyone else bar us. No, there was in the profit margin of closing all the docks, all the warehouses and everything, and making these £500,000. I lived round by the Surrey Commercial Dock just after the war. No one wanted to live around there during the war years. But now, tell you what, you couldn't afford one.
They wanted to become estate agents, the PLA. Port of London Authority, they wanted to become estate agents. Where we grew up in Rotherhithe, we never... Did you ever see an estate agent when you was growing up?
Oh, well.
Never saw a rent office, let alone a stone and ace. And now, it's inundated with estate agents.
I think there's an element of truth in it. I think particularly with the docks that were closest to London. For example, the St Catherine docks is literally about a 10-minute walk away from the city. So therefore, it was prime real estate and people were going to make money out of it. I think with the docks that were further away from the centre of the city, that wasn't the case. They were not a developer's dream at all.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown.
Whatever the reasons for the change, the human toll was indisputable. Between 1966 and 1976, Fiona Rule says more than 150,000 jobs were lost in the dock boroughs, 20% of the total jobs in the area.
Oh, the times, they are a-changing.
I think what we need to remember as well, that the loss of the Port of London didn't just result in the loss of jobs, it resulted in the loss of entire communities that had lived and worked along the banks of the Thames for generations.
Those who could moved to the suburbs.
The dock workers and the watermen, they were working people. They didn't have independent wealth. They had to go where the work was. And once the work was removed, they had to move on because they had to find other jobs. And so most of them moved out to the sort of the outer reaches of London and the counties that surround London. So there's a lot of ex-dock workers in Essex and Hertfordshire and Kent. And, you know, the watermen did the same thing. They just went out to the areas where they felt that they could find work.
Kevin Brown mourns the community that was lost.
My grandparents on both sides were dockers. They was corn porters. Like, you just went in there with your family. This was the strength of the London docks, was it was all family. You supported each other, rightly or wrongly, whatever way. And they taught you the trade as such. I mean, it wasn't a trade where you could say I was a tradesman, but not many people can load ships, can they, or discharge ships. So.
River society changed as well.
You had, like, pubs lived off of people going to have a drink. You had restaurants where people go and have a meal.
you had paper shops that sold cigarettes and papers and that, and you had schools. You had, everybody lived off of that community.
Yeah.
It was a community, and they destroyed a community. That's what they'd done.
Those forced to stay in the area had difficulty finding work.
Former watermen and dock workers were forced to go and work in factories, learn new skills. I know a lot of people went into the printing industry, for example, and apprenticed in print, where they had always thought that they would be following their fathers and becoming a stevedore or, you know, a dock worker or whatever. So, it was just a massive sea change in the way those communities operated and where they lived.
John Elliston is one of those who left the river completely.
They started closing the docks down, which was in my area where I lived, the Rotherhithe, St Catherine's Docks, West India Dock, Surrey Commercial Dock, and all the docks. The walls were in decline, they was going. I had to travel to Tilbury to get my work. Don't get me wrong, it's a good job and it was earning, but the travelling time was impossible. You had to be there at 7, because the dock had started at 7. At, say, 2 o'clock, when basically you only had a couple of hours to go, what they would say to you, our governor say, would you mind doing some overtime, would you? Answer, but there again, you had to work till 9 o'clock. Then you had to get a train from Tilbury Town. I was getting home at 11 o'clock. Then you had to be back again the next morning. We had a sit down, my wife and I, and I said to my pal, I said, this is ridiculous. The only place of work basically is either Purfleet, Tilbury, and all them graves in it, and which is far afield for me, 25 miles out of my like travelling time. You know, you wasn't getting home. Your life was all up the creek. And there was called severance going at that time, a certain amount of money they was offering in my time. And I said to my wife, what do you think? She said, John, if you're not happy in the job, come out of it. She said, it's as simple as that.
I used to see her, I used to come home really soaking wet sometimes and, you know, all in his wet clothes all day long. And it used to worry me because, you know, I used to sort of not feel well sometimes.
Pat, John Elliston's wife.
Well, we just both agreed that he'd had enough then, even though as much as he loved it, he really did love it.
Now, I came out of it on August, February the 14th in 1980, after doing 26 years on the river. And basically, I didn't even have a job to go to. I wrote to British Telecom, I wrote to Gas Board, I wrote to the bank, didn't I, Pat? And then, eventually, I wound up in a job. It was strange, really. I worked 22 years in a school as a maintenance officer.
And the first one now will later be last, cause the times, they are a-changing.
Ever resourceful, the other waterman made ends meet too. Alan Jennings piloted tugs carrying out engineering work, then crewed a ferry. Eddie Chamberlain went into computers.
I went for an interview as a computer engineer. And I knew nothing. There was three managers sitting there. They asking me questions and I didn't know what to do. I mean, they asking me about oscilloscopes and things like that. And I said, stop. I said, obviously I'm wasting your time and you're wasting mine. I said, we might as well call it a day. And I got out. I said, I'm sorry. And one bloke said, in exact words, he said, I like you, bud. I'm going to give you a job. And he said, you'll get all in the post tonight or tomorrow and it'll be an offer of a job. And I got a job, and they sent me to the States for 6 months, really heavy stuff, to learn about computers, you know. And now I never looked back from there. I studied, and I became a top engineer, didn't I, when I met you, wasn't I, you know. And that was from a waterman and lighterman who had no background in academics or anything.
But for some, it didn't work out so well.
We did painting and decorating. I got a job as a steel erector, but I didn't think they wanted me to work that high. but I soon found out otherwise.
Terry Carver.
And latter part, I became a skipper in my own right in the pleasure craft, where I finished up the remainder of the few years. Sadly, that came to an end when the Marchioness got sunk.
The sinking of the Marchioness was the greatest tragedy on the Thames in recent memory. 51 people died in 1989, the night the pleasure boat was sunk by the dredger Bow Bell near the Cannon Street Railway Bridge in central London. The impact of the disaster almost brought the river trade, already in steep decline, to a complete halt.
But everyone who was at work that night, probably two-thirds of us, was not at work the next day, was we? Because the river sort of suddenly stopped. And everyone then was looking around to blame, you know, the blame game creeps in. Accidents are accidents, unfortunately, but, you know, if you can blame someone, then But that is how the river's gone now.
Because what actually happened?
Nobody really knows. I think the only answer I would give you there is to say I was out that night, but we weren't there. And I think that is a wise thing to say, because everyone has opinions. It changed the river completely, and it affected our jobs very badly. After the Marchioness, I never done another day's work on the river. So that gives you an idea how it affected it.
He managed to get a job lorry driving, and that's where he fell off and smashed all his heel.
Vera, Terry Carver's wife.
So that was the end of it. And then after that, he couldn't work. And that was you then, 58.
I had to go ashore again. And then I had an accident, I fell off the containers. And of course, that was the end of my working life, full stop. If I ever have a day out, I just stand there looking one of those forlorn people. Can't believe what I'm looking at.
But for the watermen, working on the River Thames had always been dangerous.
That river, when we worked on it, was just filthy, dirty. It was a cesspit. It was tar and oil, where the ships just pumped out their rubbish into the river. You had your barge alongside a ship, and you could be walking along, and they could pump out crap, and it would come over you, or it would be down your barge. I mean, nobody worried about cleanliness.
And Eddie Chamberlain still bears the scars today.
We used to load asbestos, blue asbestos, which now is terrible stuff. And we used to sweep it all up, all dust. And I used to put handkerchief over my face and breathe it. When you took the handkerchief off, you could see this blue-grey stuff there. Now I've got COPD because it comes later in life. I have to have pumps, but nobody in them days thought about it.
Well, you'd always talk one hand for you, one hand for the governor, and keep your eyes about you, etc.
As a tugboat skipper working on engineering projects like the Thames Barrier, Alan Jennings is well aware of the dangers of the river.
One of our lads was on one of the ropes, the springs, what they call the springs, and what happened, this rope snared up a bit. Now, these polypropylene ropes, they stretch like rubber bands. And when they start stretching like that and vibrating, you just leave them. But he didn't, he tried to clear it, and eventually it went like a cannon. And it come back and it just literally chopped him in half. And he went in the water, still alive, trying to swim.
And tragedy hit even closer to home.
My grandfather, he got killed, he fell down the barge. And my uncle, which I've got the news cut in here, his tug was cut down by an American ship, Collier. And he was the only one saved out of the whole crew of the tug. And it did affect him afterwards because he was quite ill.
You're listening to Rogues and Vagabonds, the Watermen of the River Thames. I'm Jean DiMarino. When we come back, you'll hear how time has treated the watermen and the River Thames. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.